This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Devotion to a masculine god was not always as widespread as it is today, nor were feminine deities always relegated to the gender roles that our current society considers traditional. Over 6,000 years ago, Sumerians worshipped the supreme being of Inanna, goddess of everything from sex to political power. And while feminine deities and saints are still important figures in modern pantheons, many have been demoted from their original standing, from supreme mothers of creation like Pachamama down to the Black Madonna. Author and psychologist Rachel Wooten explores one tradition of divine femininity that has persisted in Tibetan Buddhism. Her new book is Tara, The Liberating Power of the Female Buddha, and she joins us now. Rachel, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. We should start by telling us a little bit about who Tara is and about Tara's origins.
Well, I'm going to briefly tell you the story that we have from Tibet, which is actually a little bit later, probably got developed somewhere between the 8th and 10th century. But it's a story of a woman, which is important. She was an actual person whose name was Wisdom Moon. And it became apparent to a group of monks that she was quite fantastic. And so they approached her and they said, wow, you know, you really got what it takes. So too bad you're not a man. Why don't you pray to become a man in your next lifetime or transform yourself into a man right here on the spot, which is an interesting tip of the hat to shamanism. We can talk about that if you want to. But anyway, she first explains the Dharma to them and says, actually, gender is an empty concept. So it's not possible that only men can become enlightened. And so she vowed on the spot that she would only become enlightened in a female body. And the story goes on that over eons of her helping people, liberating people, et cetera, she ultimately became enlightened and she also became a Buddha. So it's an incredibly important story if you think about it, arising in a patriarchal culture, in a patriarchal time. We have this story of a woman who refuses to go along with the idea that she, because she's a woman, can't become enlightened. So this story gets carried forward in the Tibetan tradition until this very day, which is pretty remarkable.
Well, remarkable in that a story like that wasn't successfully suppressed. I don't know if there are any efforts to suppress it, but not only was it not suppressed, but the deity as a figure, right, and as an archetype, has so much powerful imagery and has persisted and remains an important figure today, as it had through the millennia, really. Talk about the figure itself and how, you know, so how Tara looks and how Tara as a goddess has been understood, or deity or figure, an archetype, if you prefer, has been understood through all that time.
Well, it's interesting that you use these different words, and I think many people see Tara as a goddess, some people see her as an archetype. In the actual Tibetan tradition, she's thought of as a meditation deity. I put that in quotes. And she appears, when you do her practice, you visualize her appearing in front of you in a subtle body of green light. So it's like a rainbow. You can see the rainbow, but it's not a solid thing. And so this is the important part, her right foot, she's sitting on a beautiful lotus cushion, but her right foot is forward, coming off the cushion, which means she comes to your assistance the minute you need help. But her left foot is in the meditation pose, which suggests that when she goes to help, she's coming from this position of wisdom and compassion. And then her right hand is open in this gesture of giving, and her left hand is at her heart in the gesture of refuge. And, you know, depending on what you'd like to talk about, I could say a lot about the gesture of refuge. It's extremely important. But the idea really is, when you're visualizing this image of Tara, this awakened, enlightened female Buddha in this body of subtle light, it's really an outer image of an inner reality. So the idea is it's supposed to connect us with our own inner awakened self. and our own desire to be compassionate and wise and do good things in the world. So that's how she appears.
And is that how she's been understood through the millennia? That's how she has been meditated on and represented? Or has that idea that you just expressed gone through many changes over that time?
You know, really, I think it's consistent over the millennia. And I think it's one of the things that is really potent with Tibetan Buddhism. I have a feeling, you know, when Tara arose, you would have thought, well, gosh, that will help the Tibetan women a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think, oh, this is, you know, not a patriarchal tradition. Well, it really has been up until this Dalai Lama, and still is in many places. But I think that the reason she became so important in Tibet, she's as important in Tibet as Mary is to Catholics, is because everyone needs this image of this powerful, nurturing, wise being in a female image. So apparently the men, the monks, are the ones that preserve this practice literally well over 1,000 years, pretty much in the same form that it existed back then. So I think it's very consistent over time. And in this tradition, like my teacher, who lives in Switzerland, knows who his teacher was, and he knows who his teacher was. And you can trace this lineage of teachings, you know, some say all the way back to the Buddha, but definitely back to a teacher named Atisha, who lived in about the year 1000.
Well, let's see how this also sort of meshes with your training as a Jungian analyst, this exploration of the archetypal gender is sort of one of the quests here, but it gets a little tricky to try to navigate or describe sort of the divine feminine and try not to overlap too much with femaleness, you know. So if we can maybe pull that apart and talk about your training as a Jungian analyst and how that mode of inquiry informs your understanding of Tara.
Well, I'd like to say two things. One is, from the perspective of what Jung really was emphasizing, but also from the perspective of the tradition. You know, I think Jung was trying to say we have these inborn archetypes, and all of us have them. And so within us, we have the archetype of the divine mother, the good mother, the bad mother, et cetera, et cetera, or the father or the hero or whatever, you know, archetype you're looking at. And it's also true that archetype really doesn't come alive for us. You know, like we have brain cells to learn all languages, but we don't learn language unless we hear it. The archetype doesn't come alive for us unless we meet it. And so when you see this image of Tara, again, this sort of wise and vast and you could say all-knowing being, you're not really ascribing to her characteristics of a man or a woman. You're really ascribing characteristics of wisdom and compassion and knowledge, etc. But from a Jungian standpoint, when we meet that image, we hear the story, kind of like what you were just talking about with the folks before me, you have a visual image, which is powerful. You have a story, which is powerful. And then you have a practice, which is powerful. That brings the archetype alive in us.
Well, that talk more about how you think that works, because I do think that's fascinating. I think something that's missing in a lot of certainly religious teaching these days, the idea that the divinity is within you. This idea may be lost these days, that it's not something you get or achieve. You have it. And gaining access to it may require some kind of doing. It may require some kind of rethinking and reseeing. But you're not going to get it. You got it. And so talk about maybe how this worked for you. Maybe that's the story to tell right here, is how you became interested in Tara and how you initially discovered her with a vision.
You know, I joke around when people ask me, how did you discover Tara? And I say, shall we go back to the Big Bang?
That's right. The earth cooled.
But I will say that, you know, and again, this is not, oh, go read my book. But in my book, I really do talk about how her roots go back, you know, through time, through shamanism to Sumeria, actually. But I studied all those things along the way. And then I got very interested in the Black Madonna, a topic unto herself. And then there was a book published about Tara and the Black Madonna, and the great story how I got that book. But anyway, that was the first time I ever heard of Tara. And then I was doing a meditation practice with one of my teachers, actually, in Germany, Mother Mira, who teaches in silence, actually. And in that meditation, the name Padmasambhava started repeating itself in my head, only I did not know who Padmasambhava was. I wasn't even sure it was a person. So I asked one of my friends, and he said, actually, it's a person. And he brought Buddhism into Tibet. Well, that was quite an experience. So I ended up following up on that. I moved to Zurich to train as a Jungian analyst. And when I did that, there were Jungians that I met who were connected to the Tibetans who lived in Switzerland. That's how I met my teacher. So I told him that story, and then he said, ha, you have a connection to Tara. And that was the beginning of learning the practices, learning the philosophy. You know, you wouldn't call it a theology, but it's a profound set of teachings that come through the Buddhist tradition. So that's how I got into it. And then once I discovered these practices, which are very powerful, and they really do, I'm so interested in the, just what you were talking about before me. It's like this story of a woman who is very strong and very wise and very powerful. Well, I could see myself in her, right? And then you have the stories of the lineage teachers. And so you have these ancestral stories of other people. And then you have the actual practices. So I sort of plugged into all those different levels.
Well, I'm very curious to know how you feel, what you think is going on here. You talk about sort of having this visual, this story. So something very palpable, something that could be objective. You can tell the story. You could show the image. You could, I mean, statues have been made. There's all kinds of representations that one can find if you search Tara. And that's objective. And then something happens to you very personally and internally that is transformative. What do you think is happening? Is there a deity from somewhere else reaching into you, or are you using your imagination in a creative way to access something, as we said before, you've already got? You just need something to kind of hang on to get you there. What's going on, do you think?
You know, I think this is where we actually really touch into the realm of mystery. And I think that it's not either or. I think there are, you know, for instance, if you go to statues and altars of the Black Madonna, you'll find crutches and wheelchairs left behind there where people were praying to her and could get up and walk out. And there are stories from Tibet about Tara like that. So what's happening there? You know, I think that is a mystery. On the other hand, when you actually are doing these practices, and you're visualizing a subtle body, which is an energy body, you begin to connect with your own subtle energy. You also chant mantras. When you chant the mantras, the vibrations of the mantras and the meaning of the mantras also kind of create a vibration in the body. And so what happens, and it's happened for me countless times, is that energy, it's a very energetic practice, that energy flowing through. And again, you have this story of this powerful woman who stood up for herself and all women and all people, really. In the background, you have the image, you have the mantra. What happens is the actual nervous system settles down. You know, it's like our nervous system is set up to go good, bad, right, wrong, black, white. And it's set up to feel threat and to contract, et cetera, et cetera. I can be in a state like that and do these practices, and my nervous system will settle down. And then what happens is I will experience a state of really vast spaciousness. And then things will just come to me like, oh, you know, that thing that bothered you so much yesterday, that's all about something that happened in your childhood. I mean, that's just one example. Mm-hmm. But I think the practices themselves, the energy that moves when you do them helps calm the nervous system down and opens up other areas of the brain, if you yeah, want to say that.
Sure.
But yeah.
Well, I think anybody who, you know, if you go search polyvagal theory and understand how the nervous system works and know that we have access to the highest levels of thinking in the brain that get cut off when we're afraid. And that part of the brain that then engages and says, look, enemy, friend, that's the deal. There are no connections. We're not connected to anything. That's a lion. Let's run. In that state, you're in the lowest state, you know, of this polyvagal hierarchy, and sadly don't have access to what's in your own brain that would say, you know, but there's a lot of friends here who could, if we surrounded a lion, could make noise and then it'd run away. So I feel like there's some real tangible kind of neurobiological roots to this that would, I think, dovetail quite beautifully to what you're doing. Do we need more of it?
I've
only given you 30 seconds, but what should we take from this moving forward socially? Because obviously we're in a rough place socially.
You know, I think that what we should take moving forward is the basic teaching behind all of this is the interconnectedness of all being. And that we are connected to everyone and everything, and that everything we do for other people, you know, people of color, people of anything, you know, all people that we can help, helps us. If we help ourselves, we help them. We are so connected to the natural world to be active and alert and caring for our environment, because this is a practice and a theory of interbeing, of relationship. Not either or, black, white, you, me. It's, you know, all of us together. And so the practice helps us, you know, release fear, go into those open spaces, feel less alone, and actually be inspired to act. I mean, Tara is actually a karma deity. And her
Rachel, I'm going to have to cut it off here. They're going to have to read your book now. The book is Tara, The Liberating Power of the Female Buddha. Rachel Wooten is the author. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Frank Stachow.